This is Audible.
Recorded books and one-click digital present The Lost Airman by Seth Meyerowitz and Peter F. Stevens. Narrated by Jonathan Todd Ross. Forward. January 2012. So here I am sitting on a plane on my way to Europe. It's the middle of January 2012, and this will be my first time in Europe. I'm headed on an adventure, a personal pilgrimage of sorts, some 68 years in the making. I am hoping to pay tribute to Arthur Meyerowitz and a valiant band of French men and women who saved his life in 1944. I'm filled with excitement and unable to sleep. I have no idea what awaits me in France, what vestiges remain of Arthur and what or who I will find when I arrive. The thought that I might talk with people who actually knew the airman, Arthur Meyerowitz, conjures emotions I could not have imagined a month ago. Less than a month ago, I didn't know Arthur Meyerowitz, at least not in the way that you can really know someone. I knew he was born in the Bronx. I knew he had a brother, Seymour, and his parents were David and Rose. I knew that he went to war to fight for his country at 25, a few years younger than I am now. And when he took his flight to France aboard a B-24 bomber named Harmful Lil Armful, he too didn't know what to expect or what awaited him. What he did know was, more likely than not, he wouldn't be coming home. Staff Sergeant Arthur Meyerowitz was a top turret gunner in the U.S. Army's 8th Air Force, and he was going to war. I knew that Arthur hadn't made more than 2 flights before he was shot down by the Luftwaffe, and that his family desperately hoped for news from the War Department. It was months before any news would come. He was considered MIA, an American Jew in Nazi-occupied France, and he was in trouble. No one knew if he was alive or dead until he stumbled into Gibraltar more than 6 months later. And, lastly, I knew that people in France had saved his life. I could remember that the French national anthem was played at my bar mitzvah and other big family events, but never understood the magnitude or the true significance of what it had meant. This is what I knew for my whole life about my grandfather Arthur. Then, in December 2011, all of that would change. How it all started. It started with an invitation to Spain. I had met some people while vacationing in Mexico, and they invited me to visit them in Madrid. I looked at the logistics and realized I could make it work, in under a month, no less. I asked my father, Arthur's son, where Arthur had been in France. I wanted to see if perhaps I could visit those places and look around. There was no information to pass on. My father simply didn't have insight for me. Arthur died more than 10 years before I was born, and a box of letters and a couple of vague stories were the only things that remained of Arthur's wartime experiences. A challenge, I thought to myself. I was pretty computer savvy, having grown up fascinated by computers and the Internet. I learned to build websites at the age of 12 and had transitioned that into a career in the online marketing world. In some ways, I had been training most of my life to crack this case. I could not have imagined, however, just how remarkable a story awaited me. First, I looked through a forgotten box of letters written in French to my grandfather from the French men and women who had saved him. Once I got online, it took me only about 24 hours to make my first major discovery. Arthur's recently declassified government file and debrief from when he turned up in Gibraltar some 6 months after the Germans blasted Harmful Lil Armful out of the skies above France. Within 36 hours, I found a book about the resistance by a scholar named Bernard Boyer, whose pages included some of the French men and women who had written to Arthur after the war. By the end of the first week, I was on the phone with Patrick, the son of Gisèle Chauvin, a brave and amazing resistance operative who took Arthur in at one of the most perilous points of his journey, and surely saved his life. So here I am, flying to meet Patrick and his family, going to meet Bernard, whose father was the head of a resistance group who saved Arthur as well. I have appointments to meet museum directors and local historians who could help me unravel my grandfather's harrowing odyssey in occupied France all those years ago. I even persuaded my father to accompany me on this search, this once-in-a-lifetime journey. All of this has happened in about 3 weeks. January 3, 2015. It is just over 71 years since Arthur's journey into France, and just about 2 years from my first trip there. I was lucky enough to make 2 more trips to France in November of 2013, and then in August of 2014 with some of my family. There were 8 of us, and it was truly incredible to be able to bring my family and the Chauvins together. We spent several wonderful days with Patrick and his family, and 3 generations of Meyerowitzes got to experience what it was like to be in France, in the towns and places our father, grandfather, and great-grandfather survived in. We went back to the Chauvins' home in L'Espar, went to the Maquis outside that town, visited Toulouse and the landmarks there, and made some amazing memories that I'm sure Arthur could never have imagined. We are just days away from submitting our first draft of this manuscript, and I can't believe how far the story has come and how much more we have uncovered. With the help of countless experts, archive visits, solid research by our writer, Peter Stevens, and some lucky finds, we have been able to piece together this incredible story, one that is so much more in-depth than I ever could have imagined. I have taken the time to put the story I've discovered down on paper, and hope I have done it justice. I hope it pays respect to the French families and individuals who risked, and in many cases, gave up their lives for Arthur, a single man in a massive war. So now I think I know Arthur, at least more than I had when this all started. He was an incredible man and fought through so much to make it back home to his family. He was brave and heroic, but knew he could never repay those people who had saved him more than 70 years ago. This is my attempt to repay the favor, to expose this adventure, and shed light on the French resistance groups and the war that was being fought on the ground in France. Not the war fought by the Allied and Axis armies. Instead, the war fought by the people of France, who wanted their freedom and gave all they had to secure it, but still found it in their hearts to make the ultimate sacrifice for a man they never knew, who just dropped from the sky one day. Here is Arthur's story, and the story of countless people whom he crossed paths with. I hope you enjoy reading it, as much as I've enjoyed putting it together. Prologue. A Needle in a Haystack. On June 18, 1944, a young man lurched across the searing sand of Rockaway Beach, New York. As he picked his way through a maze of blankets, beach chairs, and umbrellas, throngs of beachgoers stared at him. He looked out of place in long pants hiked up to his ankles and a sweat-dampened white button-down shirt embroidered with his name. Among the crowd in bathing suits and trunks, it was not his attire that caught people's attention. It was the cardboard sign he held aloft. He was looking for the proverbial needle in a haystack. The young man had received a frantic telephone call an hour earlier at the beachfront candy store where he worked. An urgent voice had launched him out into the sweltering heat with a message he had hastily scrawled on the cardboard. He was hoping to find someone, a husband and wife whom he had never met, had never even seen. Scores of men and women were watching the candy clerk as they enjoyed the hot summer day, some casting brief glances, others staring intently. They instinctively understood the sign's message. America had now been at war with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan for some 2.5 years, and most people on the beach knew someone in uniform. Many had lost a loved one in action. As more and more beachgoers realized what the young man was doing, they stepped aside to let him pass. A handful of the more curious ones trailed him down the shoreline. Frequently wiping his brow, squinting from the sunlight, he wandered up and down the beach for more than an hour, his face flushed from the heat and visibly sunburned. As the minutes dragged on, he could not help but think that he had been dispatched on a well-intentioned but futile errand. He wondered what the chances were that his message would find the 2 total strangers in the dense crowds. Still, he kept walking, with the sign over his head, through the forest of umbrellas. He stopped to take a few long breaths, his arms aching from holding up the sign. Several yards behind him, a middle-aged couple and a pretty, black-haired young woman stumbled through the thick white sand toward him. Tears streamed down their sun-darkened faces. They had spotted the words hastily scrawled on the cardboard sign. Chapter 1. Just a Milk Run. December 31st, early morning of New Year's Eve, 1943. Seething Airfield, Norfolk, England. An icy gust slapped against Staff Sergeant Arthur Meyerowitz as he stepped outside from the 448th Bomb Group's aluminum-walled mess hall, just after 5 a.m. Wincing, he turned up the fleece collar of his leather bomber jacket and tugged his cap and earmuffs tightly. He peered for a few moments at the neat rows of cylindrical barracks arrayed on frost-cloaked farmland along the southern flank of Seething Airfield, home to his unit, the 715th Squadron in Norfolk, England. He lingered on the mess hall's stoop as other airmen and pilots brushed past him. A hell of a way to spend the last day of the year, he thought. But he had to do the pre-mission checks for Harmful Lil Armful, a B-24 Liberator in the 448th Bomb Group. He had been up since 2:30 a.m., when he had been rousted from sleep by an officer's flashlight and ordered to go out with Harmful Lil Armful, whose flight engineer and top turret gunner, Sergeant George Glevenick, had just been rushed to the base hospital. Now, after the pre-mission briefing and breakfast, Arthur steeled himself for his second mission. His maiden mission had come on December 24th aboard a B-24 named Consolidated Mess. The target was a Nazi V-1 missile site at Le Bois, a relatively short hop across the English Channel in the Pas-de-Calais, in northern France. With luck, Arthur might be back at Seething in time for the New Year's Eve parties that he had planned to attend on base, and in Norwich, some 10 miles away on the east coast. Lucky bastard, he mused about Glevenick, shivering. At least Glevenick was guaranteed to make it into 1944. Then Arthur lowered his shoulder against the raw wind and stepped off the stoop onto a muddy path that wound toward 3 concrete airstrips. A few yards from the mess hall, Arthur spotted a group of young Englishwomen, slowed down, and removed his cap and earmuffs as he passed them. Despite the early hour, they were waiting to pick up their 8th Air Force boyfriends who had 2-day passes for New Year's Eve and day. Usually, the girlfriends had to stand outside the main gate, but they had been allowed on the base for the holidays after a security check. As they waited for their airmen to emerge from the building, the women were chatting amid a swirl of cigarette smoke. Running his hand through his dense, dark hair, Arthur shot them a grin. Several smiled back at the handsome 25-year-old airman. A pretty blonde spotted Arthur's shoulder patch, which was emblazoned with the image of a grinning, muscular rabbit clad in a superhero's costume and cape, who was perched atop a light blue bomb. "The 715th, is it? Where are the rabbits off to, then, in such a rush, so close to New Year's?" she called out. "We've got a date with some Germans," he he replied.
Good luck, and give the bastards our regards.
Another woman chimed in as Arthur picked up his pace and waved. Attention from women was something Arthur was used to. The 5'10", 160-pound staff sergeant possessed the street smarts and swagger of his Bronx neighborhood, and he exuded a confidence to which women were drawn. Before enlisting in the army, Arthur had loved dressing stylishly, heading to the garment district, and stretching part of his paychecks into good deals on fashionable clothes. His family was accustomed to seeing beautiful young women on his well-tailored sleeves. At Norfolk, Arthur enjoyed chatting with attractive English women, but it never went beyond a few pints and dances in town or on base. Tucked in the breast pocket of his flight suit, his wallet held a snapshot of Esther Lowe, his dark-haired, dark-eyed girlfriend back in the Bronx. An aunt had introduced him to the pretty 21-year-old Esther before he had shipped out to England, and he was quickly smitten, so much so that he had considered marriage. He had decided, however, that with the casualty rate of bomber crews in the European and Pacific theaters of operation reaching the highest of any service branch, even more than the submarine fleet, he could not justify making her another in the sadly burgeoning ranks of young war widows. Still, she intended to wait for him, and he could not talk her out of it. Arthur carried another memento of home besides Esther's photo. Around his neck was a thin gold chain with a chai, the Hebrew symbol for life. His mother had given it to him before he had left for England. As the rows of B-24s lining the airstrip materialized through the mist and freezing rain, Arthur had no time to think of Esther and of his parents and brother back in New York. Harmful Lil Armful had to be inspected, and his crewmates depended on Arthur, the flight engineer, to make sure that the plane was fit to fly. Everyone knew that the Allied invasion of Fortress Europe loomed. The waves of American and British bombers pounding German targets in France around the clock were preparing the ground for Operation Overlord, the largest amphibious assault in history. What no one except the top brass knew yet was where and when the Allies would strike across the British Channel. A few hours earlier at the mission briefing, the 448th's charismatic commander, 37-year-old Colonel James M. Thompson, had unveiled a huge map of Europe and thrust a pointer at three red-circled spots. Silence enveloped the crowded room as the pilots and crews waited to hear Thompson, whose neatly parted salt-and-pepper hair and trim Clark Gable mustache made him the very picture of a tough pilot and leader, speak in his no-nonsense Texan drawl. From airfields across eastern and central England, 250 B-17s and B-24s, including Harmful Lil Armful, would be escorted by hundreds of P-47 Thunderbolt and P-51 Mustang fighter planes as they unleashed a daylight strike against the Nazi airfield at La Rochelle-l'Alleud, southwest of the Brest Peninsula. If the clouds over the site proved too dense, the secondary target was another Nazi airstrip, at Chateau Bernard. Thompson, a nerveless pilot who had racked up 55 missions over Europe and had earned a reputation for never sugarcoating danger for his men, told the assembled airmen that German flak and fighter attacks all the way into and out of the target run would be intense. Arthur knew they would soon be in the soup over France. Arthur could never have envisioned that he would see France or England, let alone go to war. Still, the eldest son of David and Rose Meyerowitz had always thirsted for adventure. Arthur was born on August 15, 1918, in the Bronx, in a tough neighborhood largely composed of Jewish, Irish, and Italian families, crowded into old yellow-brick flat-roofed apartment buildings that clotted Finley Avenue. At 1205 Finley Avenue, built in 1915, the Meyerowitz family lived in a third-floor, one-bedroom apartment. David and Rose had a second child, Seymour, on August 11, 1927. When Seymour was old enough, he and Arthur shared a Murphy bed in the living room. 43-year-old David Meyerowitz had emigrated from Romania to New York as a boy and had been compelled to leave school at eighth grade to help the family survive. He went on to work as a driver and salesman in the wholesale bakery business and to marry Rose Blumenthal, a vivacious, dark-haired woman born and raised in the Bronx. With the onset of the Great Depression in 1929, times turned increasingly tight for the Meyerowitz family and their Finley Avenue neighbors. David always managed to keep his family fed, housed, and clothed, but money was always short. He and Rose were constantly juggling the bills, unable to think about moving out of their apartment. To survive on Finley Avenue, Arthur learned how to use both his instincts and his fists. He had to because on the corners of Finley and adjoining streets, Russian and Eastern European Jews, Irish and Italian kids claimed patches of local asphalt as their personal turf. In Arthur's building, people watched out for each other, and when a job was lost or an illness struck families, neighbors helped out as best they could. Raised to respect women and imbued with a strong sense of right and wrong, Arthur was never afraid to stand up to bullies. Once, when the din of a man beating his wife echoed down the third-floor hallway of the apartment complex, Arthur rushed toward the noise and started banging on the neighbor's apartment door. The husband opened it, red-faced and sweating. In the small living room, his wife was sobbing, her clothes disheveled, bruises rising on her face. Arthur, clenching his fists at his side, glared at the older man, who backed away a step as Arthur stood in the doorway, saying nothing, his eyes still fixed on the neighbor. Then Arthur leaned forward, jabbed a finger just under the man's chin, and nodded in the direction of the cringing woman. Arthur turned around and waited for the door to close. He lingered in the hall, listening as the man and the woman talked in low, almost hushed tones. There were no more slaps or shouts. Over the following days and weeks, it became apparent that the husband had gotten the message. If he threatened his wife again, his tough young neighbor would give him a dose of the same. The beatings stopped. Arthur graduated from Robert Morris High School, built in 1897 as the first public high school in the Bronx, and the education he received in the soaring Gothic brick structure, complete with turrets and spires, was rated as one of the finest offered by any of the city's public high schools. In the school's sprawling auditorium, Arthur and the rest of the student body gathered for daily assemblies amid the hall's ornate columns and a commemorative World War I mural that would earn the school a place on the National Historic Register. Arthur saw that masterpiece daily for 4 school years. The mural had been rendered by renowned French artist Auguste Gorgeous, and entitled After Conflict Comes Peace. At the time, the vivid images of war-scarred France did not matter much to the teenager. After his 1936 graduation from Morris, Arthur immediately began working. Any thought of college was out of the question with the Depression still battering the nation and the family needing every dollar. He sold electrical fixtures for Jack Meyerowitz, his uncle, and doubled as a receiving and shipping clerk and supervisor of 10 men for a wholesale lampshade company in Brooklyn for 3.5 years. Although fortunate to have any work in the midst of the Depression, in 1939, Arthur was employed only for 28 weeks, earning $400. Fortunately for the family, his father worked all 52 weeks and brought home $1,560. But there was never much left over after the bills were paid. Wanting to contribute more and finding his life too sedate despite his busy social calendar, Arthur began to think about other avenues for a steadier and more exciting financial future. He had always been interested in airplanes and yearned for the chance to fly. And in late 1940, he spoke to an army recruiter in Manhattan about the Army Air Corps. The sergeant told Arthur that a college education was not mandatory for aviation cadets, so long as they had graduated from a good high school. The recruiter added that once Arthur completed basic training, he could transfer to the Air Corps if he passed the physical and mental examinations. Filled with excitement, Arthur, who had never traveled beyond New York and New Jersey, signed a 1-year enlistment paper on January 8, 1941. He was formally inducted at Fort Dix, New Jersey, and was soon on his way to basic infantry training at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Once he completed basic, Arthur made 2 requests to his commanding officer: a pass to attend Seymour's Bar Mitzvah in New York, and the application to transfer to the Army Air Corps. The officer turned down the Bar Mitzvah pass brusquely, and then set Private Meyerowitz straight regarding aviation training. Arthur had signed up for 1 year, and the Army did not allow such enlistees to waste its time and money in flight school. The recruiting sergeant had lied to him, and Arthur, furious but trapped, started counting the days until January 8, 1942, when his assignment would be complete. Meanwhile, he sent Seymour 1 month's army wages as a bar mitzvah present. He earned stellar reviews from his superiors, first as a rifleman, and then as a 50-caliber machine gunner. On December 7, 1941, about a month before his enlistment was up, Arthur was stunned by the news of the Imperial Japanese Navy's strike against Pearl Harbor. He immediately signed up for 3 more years, out of patriotism, out of the certainty that he would be drafted anyway, and out of hope that he could now transfer to the Air Corps. He wrote to Seymour that, "My life expectancy as a machine gunner will be about 13 seconds, so I want to fly and fight that way." Arthur, hard-nosed and keenly intelligent, possessed just the sort of nerve and leadership skills required in the cockpit. On June 8, 1942, his first step toward becoming an aviation cadet came when Lieutenant Colonel E.O. Lee, the commander of the 60th U.S. Regiment, 9th Infantry Division at Fort Bragg, rated him as an excellent soldier and recommended that his request for transfer to the Air Corps be accepted, with 3 non-family character references from people who had known the candidate for no less than 5 years. All 3 letters from respected New York businessmen testified that Arthur was a young man whose character is of the finest, is reliable and trustworthy, an asset to any branch of the service he might choose. All he could do now was wait it out and hope that he would not be shipped off to North Africa or the Pacific as an infantryman before a transfer could arrive. On July 16, 1942, Arthur was told to report to Lieutenant Colonel Lee. His heart racing as he hurried to his superior's office, he knew the reason. A few minutes later, Arthur stepped outside and headed to his barracks, with the news that his transfer for an aviation cadet appointment to the Air Corps had been officially accepted. Elated, he was no longer a dog face with Company H. He wanted to give his family the news immediately, but because only 1 neighbor had a phone, he had to call that number and ask that they tell Rose, David, and Seymour that Private Arthur Meyerowitz was now an aviation cadet, with the opportunity to earn his wings. The opportunity came more slowly than Arthur would have liked. Before he could claim a spot as a flight cadet, he was required to complete physical training, classroom training, and hands-on runway instruction. If he came through the regimen successfully, another physical exam awaited. Cadets had to undergo a grueling workup that washed out any number of candidates for everything from punctured eardrums to vertigo. Only then could Arthur make it all the way from the ground to the cockpit. After a processing stint in Columbia, South Carolina, to await his initial assignment in the Army Air Force, Arthur was transferred for a few months to the Army Air Base in Nashville, Tennessee, and then near Biloxi, Mississippi. He performed well both in the classroom and on the ground at the Air Corps Technical School, where would-be pilots, airmen, and ground crews, paddle feet, alike, were indoctrinated in aircraft technology and mechanics from nose to tail. The most nerve-wracking moment of Arthur's training so far came in August 1942, when he underwent the dreaded physical and classroom examinations for aviation cadets, the last hurdles before flight training. strapped to a mechanized tilt board. He was tipped in different, dizzying angles at varying speeds to measure his capacity to endure sudden dives, climbs, rolls, and loops in a fighter plane or a bomber. With no way to tell in which direction the board would move, many recruits threw up within a minute or passed out as the board's pitching and gyrations increased or decreased. If a cadet could not stand up within a few seconds after the tilt board was stopped, he was dropped from, washed out, pilot training. The cadets who managed to wobble from the board and stay on their feet were hustled immediately to an eye chart in order to read each line as fast as possible so that the doctors could determine how quickly each man's eyesight could recover from severe vertigo. If the flight candidate failed to complete the lines within 1 minute, he was out. Once the vertigo and eye tests were done, Arthur was poked and prodded from head to toe as the doctors searched for anything from a slight hearing imperfection to slow reflexes, any of which would disqualify a man. He winced as a doctor inserted a long probe into his nostrils to rule out any hint of a deviated septum or sinus anomalies. Still feeling the effects of the tilt board, Arthur and his fellow candidates had to run a mile in the sweltering Mississippi heat and have their heart rates and pulses measured. After Arthur made it through the physical, the results of which were sent for review to an Army Air Force medical board at Wendover Airfield, Utah, he faced the graduation field test. This was the final examination to measure how much flight candidates had absorbed in the classroom. Any grade less than the 80th percentile meant dismissal from the program. Arthur scored an 82, just above the 80 he needed to continue. Now he had to wait several days for the final results of his physical. On August 2nd at Wendover, an Army medical board deemed the young man from the Bronx qualified to fly. He wrote home that he would always consider it to be one of the best days of his life. Arthur was assigned to the flight training base in Laredo, Texas, a dust-choked, rough-and-tumble ranching town that still evoked the Wild West. Intrigued by the sight of genuine cowboys and wranglers on horseback, the city kid and several of his fellow cadets decided to give the saddle and reins a try on a pass into town. It certainly could not be as difficult as learning to handle a plane, Arthur reasoned. He managed to stay atop his horse during his first lesson. Then, as he was tying the reins to a hitching post, the horse snapped its head back toward him just as he was leaning forward to finish the task. With a sickening thud, the horse's snout slammed against Arthur's left eye. Arthur staggered for a moment and sank to his knees, his eye closing fast. The impact sent blood pouring from his nose. His friends helped him to his feet, laid him in the back of a jeep, and sped back to the base infirmary. Groggy from the impact, Arthur gazed with his good eye at the white-coated army doctor who appeared in front of him. The physician was Japanese. With Japanese Americans rounded up in the wake of Pearl Harbor as potential threats to the nation, and languishing in heavily guarded camps on the order of President Roosevelt and Congress, Arthur had reason to balk at treatment from the doctor. Before he could say a word, the doctor said, "I may be Japanese, but I am American. Your eye needs to be operated on, and you won't find anyone better than me for the job." Awash in pain, Arthur simply nodded. He felt sick to his stomach. At the realization of what the crack of the horse's massive snout against his face likely meant. If his eyes had not already been watering from the blow, he would have had a hard time holding back tears. The doctor proved as good as his word. Performing a retinal procedure and draining the fluid and blood pressing against the eye and the orbital socket. For an aspiring pilot, however, 20/20 vision was non-negotiable. The lingering damage to Arthur's eye was slight, but even that killed any cadet's chance to take the throttle of a bomber or a fighter. Even if Perfect Vision eventually returned, a nation at war and in dire need of combat pilots as soon as possible could not wait for such an injury to heal. Arthur did not want to return to the infantry, but he didn't want to sit on the sidelines either. The attack on Pearl Harbor and the rumors of Nazi atrocities that had seeped into Jewish communities across America in the past few years filled him with an anger he could barely describe. He wanted to fight for his country, and if he could not do it in the cockpit, he had to find a way to stay in the air, to do his bit aboard a bomber. He did not have much time to figure something out. On November 13, 1942, Arthur was ordered to appear in Wendover before an Army Air Force faculty board, which informed him that he was physically disqualified for further flying duty because of physical disability. Arthur then requested that he be considered as an Army Air Force Officer School administrative candidate, noting his stellar record in Air Technical School and in all phases of his training up to his accident. It was a long shot because men with at least some college experience were first in line. Impressed with the record of aviation cadet Arthur Sidney Meyerowitz, a board officer asked that if his request was not favorably considered, is there any type of technical training you desire? Arthur was ready with his answer, one he had formulated over the weeks of his recovery. "Sir, in that case, I would like to be considered for training as an airplane flight engineer." The board members conferred and quickly reached a decision, acknowledging that Arthur's removal from flight training was due to physical reasons, not performance. They assigned him to training as a flight engineer. Since he was already a skilled 50 caliber machine gunner, and B-24 flight engineers doubled as the bomber's top turret gunner, he stood out as an ideal candidate. Once Arthur fully recovered from his surgery, his second round of flight training began, but this time as an engineer. The classroom training over the following months proved as intense as the training for an aspiring pilot. Arthur spent long hours in lectures for maintenance fundamentals, hydraulic systems, engines, electrical systems, fuel systems, aircraft instruments, propellers, engine operation under all sorts of duress, and aircraft inspection. He soon learned that pilots and flight engineers were required to know more about the planes they flew than bombardiers, navigators, or anyone else aboard a B-17 Flying Fortress or a B-24 Liberator. In October 1943, with his eye healed, Arthur completed two intensive weeks of training as a top ball turret gunner and was promoted to staff sergeant. Assigned to the 715th Squadron, 448th Bomber Group, he entered the third and last phase of his training at Sioux City, Iowa. All that remained before he was sent overseas were several B-24 practice flights from the airfield at Harrington, Kansas, and final classroom examinations for flight engineers. Unless he performed below required standards in both the air and on the ground, he would soon be heading off to the war. The big question was whether he would be sent to the European or the Pacific theater of operation. Pilots and crewmen were told their destination only after they shipped out. On October 30th, 1943, just 4 days before flying out from Sioux City, Arthur sat down to compose a letter to his parents. As the steam radiators of the third-floor apartment hissed and clanged, Rose Meyerowitz wiped an early November morning frost off the apartment's front window. Finley Avenue began to appear below with each rub of her cotton cloth against the glass. The street was packed with commercial panel trucks and a handful of cars beeping incessantly. People, bundled up against the gusts that occasionally rattled the apartment's windows, bustled along the street. David had left for work at 7 a.m., and Seymour had scampered out the door for school a half hour later. Spotting the mailman walking down the building's front steps, Rose laid her cloth on the windowsill. She walked downstairs to the row of metal boxes on the lobby wall, inserted her key, and pulled out several letters. Among a few bills was an envelope embossed with the logo of the Hotel West, Sioux City, Iowa. She immediately recognized Arthur's handwriting on the envelope. She rushed upstairs, settled into the worn fabric of her reading chair next to the window, and stared at the letter. Taking a deep breath, she opened it to find three pages of stationery. Dear Dad and Mom, I am writing you just before I get ready to leave the States. This is one thing I would rather not have to write you both. I know how you feel about me. All I can say to that is I feel the same way about you. Ever since I can remember, you were always swell parents. You gave me every chance to make something of myself. I have no kick coming. I am about to go overseas. I knew it was coming a long time ago. It's something I've been training a long time for. I think I have a darn good chance to see this thing through and come back to you all safe and sound. My biggest worry is your worrying about me. Please don't. You don't have to. You will see nothing is going to happen to me. If I knew you won't carry on, I would feel so much better. All I ask of you, Dad, is take good care of Mom and Seymour. I guess you know what I mean. I don't want to write any more on the subject. Just tell Mom not to worry and everything will come out okay. From what I heard today, I am going to a place I want to. It looks like it will be China. I will fly all the way. I am glad it won't be by boat. There will be times you won't get mail from me. Don't worry. It will have to take a longer time to get to you now. So try and understand above everything, don't worry about me. That's about all I can say for now. Just take good care of Mom for me. All my love to you, Artie. Rose tucked the letter into her apron pocket and closed her eyes. Arthur's bravado conjuring a slight smile for an instant, she silently prayed for Arthur's return, as she made Seymour do every morning and evening. She not only worried about Arthur, but also about Seymour and Esther. They too saw the newspapers filled with grim news of massive battles and losses in Europe and the Pacific. Rose got up from the chair, picked up the cloth, and began to dust again. After logging a scant 48 hours and 30 minutes in the air aboard B-24s, Arthur flew aboard a C-47 transport plane to Morrison Army Airfield in West Palm Beach, Florida, on November 11, 1943. Every pilot and airman knew what the assignment meant. They were shipping out for combat. With the highest casualty rate of any branch, the Army Air Corps had no choice but to rush pilots and airmen into action. At Morrison, thousands of air personnel were assembled for their overseas dispositions by the U.S. Army Air Force's ferrying command. The more fortunate bomber pilots and crews flew out to Europe or the Pacific on new bombers. When B-24s or B-17s fresh from the factories were not available, thousands of pilots and airmen were crammed aboard troop transports or converted passenger ships. 8th and 15th Air Force crews headed to England or Italy would spend 2 to 3 weeks in storm-tossed Atlantic waters where Nazi U-boats prowled the convoy routes. Some of the vessels leaving Palm Beach never made it more than a few miles from Florida before German torpedoes sent them to the ocean bottom. The grim jibe was that if a ship lumbered straight out of Palm Beach Harbor and kept going straight, you were heading into U-boat country, so kiss your ass goodbye. To Arthur's relief, he and his crewmates would not make the Atlantic crossing by ship. They had been ordered to fly out to war on a new B-24 named Made of Tin. They would not know their destination until they were in the air, and they opened a sealed envelope. Arthur and the other men of the 715th were rousted from bed at 3 a.m. on November 19, 1943, and told by an orderly that they were to ship out aboard Made of Tin with all their gear. Before climbing into the bomber with 14 other men of the 715th, including two pilots, Arthur headed to a 5 a.m. briefing. William Blum, a a pilot in the squadron, wrote, "It was still dark and very humid when we were told to report. The briefing room was crowded, and we were all conscious of the long flight before us. The briefing was short. A roll call of the crews scheduled to take off, the order to take off, photographs of landing fields along the route, a detailed account of all landmarks and aids to navigation, emergency ditching procedure, and finally a thorough weather briefing." After a quick breakfast at the mess, Arthur and the others flying out boarded jeeps to the bombers lined up on the airstrip. Blum recalled that everyone gathered for a last cigarette in our homeland before the big hop. A few days earlier at the Morrison Processing Center, Arthur had been required to make out a will and was given a quick medical examination. He named his mother, Rose, as the beneficiary of the $10,000 government death insurance accorded to the men of the 8th Army Air Corps. When Made of Tin, laden with 2,500 gallons of gas, soared above the airstrip and headed southwest through drizzling rain and a low cloud cover toward Puerto Rico, the pilot turned over the controls to the co-pilot. The skipper then reached into his flight jacket and removed a sealed envelope marked "Secret" in bold type and switched on the intercom. "Men," he intoned, "I'm about to inform you of our destination." As every crewman fell silent, the sound of the pilot tearing open the envelope could be heard faintly above the drone of the engines. The pilot said, "Your destination? The British Isles." Blum's words echoed the thoughts of Arthur. No one said a word. We had all hoped for a tour of China. The British winters meant bad weather, and the Jerrys were hot pilots. The South Atlantic crossing to Great Britain took nearly 2 weeks, with Made of Tin making required fueling stops and layovers at Puerto Rico, Trinidad, Brazil, and Dakar and Marrakesh, both in North Africa. From there, the B-24 landed at Seething Airfield, Station 146, on December 3, 1943. When Arthur first set foot at Seething on December 3, 1943, he was uncertain about what to expect. As a jeep wove across frozen mud and rutted paths to rows of barracks, several airmen waved. "You'll be sorry," a few shouted. Another crewman bellowed, "Here comes the fresh meat." Not exactly a reassuring welcome, Arthur thought. He later learned that both greetings were an 8th Air Force tradition for arriving crews. Arthur and his comrades were soon dropped off at their new home, the 715th's aluminum Nissen hut, whose uninsulated, tar-paper-covered walls housed rows of thin mattressed cots with only 3 feet separating them. The reek of the coal-fired stoves that supplied warmth against the English chill merged with cigarette smoke and the odor of wet woolen blankets and uniforms. As Arthur would soon learn, those smells seemed more fragrant to airmen each time they survived another mission and returned to Seething. Before he could fly out on an actual mission, nearly 3 weeks in Seething lecture rooms for pre-combat orientation and theater indoctrination awaited. The collective eyes of Arthur's fellow rookie crewmen and pilots often glazed over from their instructors' long-winded sermons and their exhortations that no mission was ever a milk run, a bombing run in which there was little or no flak or enemy fighter planes. Arthur and other city boys stifled laughter as young men from rural spots stared wide-eyed when lecturers sternly pontificated about venereal disease and loose women around the British airfields, where the rookies would be based. There was one lecture that proved different for Arthur, as well as the other rookie airmen. He heard the harsh warning about the odds against pilots and airmen surviving the required 25 missions over Hitler's Europe. On an average, the 8th Air Force loses 4 out of every 100 planes on every mission. Of course, some missions will be a disaster due to very aggressive enemy action. This being the case, the instructor reasoned, a crew that flies 25 missions has almost 100% chance of being shot down by its last mission. Arthur and the others sat utterly silent. It hit them full force that, in all likelihood, many of them would never see home again. Unlike some airmen, Arthur had already prepared himself for that grim possibility. Before leaving for war, he had told his younger brother Seymour, "If I'm going to die, I'd rather fly. I don't want to die on the ground." As he had told his brother, neither the eye injury nor anything else was going to stop him from fighting the Nazis. He was willing to die for his country, and as part of a B-24 crew, he knew and accepted that he was likely to do just that. Still, saying it and having air combat veterans tell it were two different things. The reality first riveted and then haunted B-24 and B-17 bomber crews, and Arthur proved no exception. Now, less than a month since he had made the long, harrowing flight from Florida to England aboard Maid of Tin, that harsh reality hit him. It had begun moments after he had been pulled out of bed at 3 a.m., and had swelled by the time the pre-flight briefing ended. To fill out crews slated to fly a mission but shorthanded by casualties, squadron leaders routinely drafted pilots and airmen who were supposed to have a day off. Arthur fully understood the necessity. What he could not quite shake was Colonel Thompson's grim visage at the briefing. Thompson had laid it out bluntly and candidly. The mission ahead would be the last for many of the crews flying out in a few hours. From the moment that the colonel had concluded the briefing with the words, "Kick their asses," Arthur's stomach had been churning. It had gotten even worse after he stepped into the mess hall for 5:30 a.m. breakfast, right after the briefing. He only picked at the scrambled eggs, ham, sausage, and toast the cooks piled onto the airmen's tin trenchers. Everyone in the mess hall could tell who was flying out that day, and who was off duty. Men who downed endless mugs of coffee and ate little or nothing had just come out of the briefing room. They also toted thermoses of coffee to help ward off the 50 below zero temperature of a B-24's cabin at 28,000 feet above the ground. As Arthur reached the bomber, he saluted the pilot, Second Lieutenant Philip Chase, and the co-pilot, Second Lieutenant William H. Thomas. A couple of cocky college boys, he thought, but decent enough guys. Still, he had no doubt that he would have been better in the pilot seat than either of them. He stopped near the front of the bomber, slowly running his fingers across the fuselage's cold steel skin, and the colorfully painted image of a buxom pinup girl clad in a white bikini top and grass skirt cradling a bomb. Her harmful lil armful. For the second time before flying into combat, he inspected a B-24's 67-foot 8-inch length, its 110-foot wingspan, and its four powerful Pratt & Whitney R-1830 turbo-supercharged radial engines, 1,200 horsepower each. German flak and fighter planes had rocked both his plane and his rookie nerves aboard Consolidated Mess on December 24th, but at least now he knew what to expect over France. As he began his inspection, he grew concerned by the pounding harmful lil armful had taken from anti-aircraft fire on her third mission. The previous day, December 30th. He was wary of the chance that any damage to the aircraft less than a day earlier might not be fully repaired. He did not have to remind himself to pay special attention to the bomber's engines. From talking with other engineers, he had learned that the B-24 Liberator could not match the B-17 Flying Fortress's capacity to endure heavy damage, and that crews had dubbed the B-24 the Flying Coffin because it possessed only two exits. The escape hatch was located near the tail of the aircraft, and a fire anywhere in front of the exit could trap the crew. The only other escape was the bomb bay, whose doors often jammed from flak's concussive waves. The aircraft was highly susceptible to fires as well. Luftwaffe fighter pilots had learned to rake several fuel tanks mounted in the B-24's upper fuselage with machine gun and nose cannon rounds and set the bomber ablaze. Once the flames spread, the B-24's gravest flaw appeared, as the wings would often buckle and crumple. On his first mission, Arthur had witnessed several doomed B-24s plunging past his bomber, their flaming wings folded upward like fiery butterflies. As Arthur and his fellow engineers and mechanics continued their pre-flight inspections, some crewmen tossed footballs in the semi-darkness between the planes and on the field's edges. Other airmen hurled baseballs, the staccato slaps of horsehide into leather gloves toted from all corners of America a poignant reminder of home, of better days. Cigarettes glowed everywhere. Dozens of trucks packed with massive 500-pound bombs lumbered up to the planes surrounding the runways. The bombardier of each crew would arm the bombs with detonation pins once the B-24s neared their French targets. Other trucks laden with steel containers that held gleaming 50-caliber machine gun belts surrounded 18 bombers arrayed along Seething's three runways. Arthur worked his way around the plane, meticulously going over each of his checkpoints twice, while the rest of harmful Lil Armful's crew arrived in the back of an open truck. They clambered out and huddled around the bomber. When he finished his inspection of engines 1 and 2 and emerged from beneath the left wing, he spied Staff Sergeant Thomas M. McNamara, a veteran of 4 missions already, and an older brother figure to several of the younger crewmen. McNamara's hand rested on the shoulder of 19-year-old Staff Sergeant William D. Dunham, an Ohio farm boy whose gaunt face was creased with worry. Arthur stopped and nodded at them. Although harmful Lil Armful's crew was not his own, Arthur had spent a lot of time at Seething with McNamara. A square-jawed, wide-shouldered Irish New Yorker with a raucous, infectious laugh, he regaled his crewmates with a bottomless font of hilarious stories from his tough upbringing in Hell's Kitchen to his family's move to Grand Rapids, Michigan. McNamara knew every inch of the B-24 and B-17 alike. Before enlisting in the Army Air Force, he had worked in Henry Ford's B-24 plant in Willow Run, Michigan. Whether he was in the freezing barracks where the 6 crews of the 715th Bomber Squad slept, the mess hall, or the briefing room, McNamara's confidence and experience always reassured his own crew and other airmen in the unit. Even the pilots sought his counsel when it came to the literal nuts and bolts workings of the bombers. At the sudden backfire of a truck's tailpipe, or perhaps even a firecracker, since it was, after all, the final day of 1943, Dunham stiffened and cursed softly, his eyes wide. "He's just nervous," McNamara assured Arthur. "He'll be fine," he added with a smile. Arthur smiled at the two men, walked over to the other wing, and crouched beneath the number 3 engine. All around the plane, other crew members were making their own pre-flight checks. Navigator and Second Lieutenant Harry K. Farrell and Bombardier and Flight Officer Edward E. George, a pair of Ivy Leaguers with the innate confidence of their upper-class pedigrees, quietly conversed and looked up to say hello to Arthur. Despite the difference in their background from the rest of the crewmen, they were, as McNamara said, good eggs. Radio operator Staff Sergeant Joseph DeFranz, a wavy-haired, gregarious 19-year-old kid from Hyde Park, Massachusetts, grinned at Arthur. "Make sure we got all 4 propellers," he joked. Arthur retorted, "Colonel Thompson told me we only need 1. Tail gunner and Staff Sergeant Howard R. Peck, who said little but had proven a deadly marksman with his 50-caliber Browning on his first 2 missions, chuckled. Arthur barely heard the laughter. He had already spied several large dents from German flak that had bent parts of the engine's casing close to the propeller. Too close for his liking. There were at least a dozen holes in the casing and the underside of the wing from where Messerschmitt 109 fighters' machine guns and nose cannons had found their mark. Knowing how vulnerable the B-24's wings were, Arthur rushed over to the 2 pilots. Saluting, he explained the damage he had found. "Sir," he said to Lieutenant Chase, "the ship is unfit to fly. The engine needs to be fixed." For a moment, Chase and Thomas stared at him. Then Chase's angular features tightened, and he glowered at Arthur.